Blog Talk Radio.
Through another few minutes of whatever I've got on my desk. Hope you're all doing well and relaxed, sitting somewhere nice and comfortable with your, of course, favorite glass of Kool-Aid at hand. It's a magnificent day, this 27th of July 2012. The 209th day of the year. Thank you for starting off the show with a little blues. Just seems to make it all fit together. Brethren, this is the kickoff for the Olympics. Stunning, stunning, brilliant, brilliant introduction. Hope you all get a chance to see it. Or listen to it if you're not near something, not near a transmission. Fantastic. 2 weeks of the finest athletics in the world. And we need to see it that way because, gosh, with all of the things going on around the world, we need something to celebrate, don't we? Little too much going well in your life? No doubt, no doubt. Tonight, I remembered a few things. I'm just, things are going just far too well, and I hope they are for you too. I think sometimes I'm the most fortunate person in this country. I know I'm certainly fortunate to be a member of the Fraternal Order. Little thought came to mind. Two things are infinite. Then all those that can fill in the blank, go right ahead. Two things that are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the universe. Now, if I tried to say that, people, you'd be throwing things, you'd be throwing your glass of Kool-Aid at your speakers. But Albert Einstein said it, so cool your jets, cool your jets. He had a few thoughts firing through his noggin. Yeah, his claim to fame was physics. Doesn't mean he could string together the English language, but man, some of the things he said. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. Matter of choices. Thanks for joining me, and with this show, I want to talk to you about choices. I want to have a little chat. I know you're going to talk back, like you always do. Some of you out there, those that were tuning into the radio and listening to Foster Hewitt a long, long time ago, you're the fellows that I want to thank most sincerely, because for all the speed bumps and complications and criticisms and nonsense that's gone on over the decades, without you fellows, we wouldn't be here today. Yeah, we can look at the new guy coming through the door, but you guys did something quite remarkable. You expanded the infrastructure of the order here in Ontario. I mean, lodges popping up in small communities. It must have been very heady times when you think about it. And then when our communities started to have that representation, the next thing we did was what we always do. We want to go out and meet the neighbors. So we began visiting. It's a refrain that's still important today. not for all the same reasons that I think some people might be thinking. I'm going to illustrate that a little bit to you. And of course, you being gullible and me being more gullible than you, maybe if we put our heads together, we can come up with something useful. Logic will get you from A to Z, he says. Al says, but imagination will get you everywhere. So tonight, in order to make this work, all I need from you again is to push out your imagination just a little bit more than usual. And let me take advantage of it for the next couple of minutes, because the great architect knows I'm going to need your help tonight. You know, the changes that we've been through are remarkable. We live in a probabilistic world, often being taught and wanting to assume that the world is very predictable, probabilistic and predictable in the same breath. That's really interesting. It's like back in the days when we had this sense of a geocentric version of the world. Earth, center of the universe, everything else spinning around us. Fabulous, fabulous idea. But at the same time that, you know, the smarty pants in the crowd were saying that, the reality was that we were heliocentric. I love these words. I love these words. And the young whippersnappers are coming up to me saying, Dale, do you know the difference between the two? Well, gentlemen, sit back. I'm going to try and give you a bit of a version of the two. One is simply saying that we had and it's also known as the Ptolemic. Now, you fellows that have all of your wits about you at this time of the evening can say that much clearer than me. Ptolemy subscribed to this notion, and he was the latter day stiffs would say, we knew he was limited, as if that was all the only thing that he contributed. But even in the 5th century BC, this notion that the world wasn't necessarily at the center, but it was spinning around and orbiting, was out there, but nobody really paid attention. Not until the 16th century, when everybody started to get serious about it. And we know what happened with those boys, eh? We had to go and get rid of them, or stifle them, or censor them. That was just far too radical for our little wizardy minds. So much turmoil seems to be generated by our own difficulty with communication and sharing ideas. I don't necessarily know if it's the idea of tolerance alone, although, yes, I subscribe to it. You've heard me say that many times here with you, and I hope you do too. But the idea comes from somewhere. And I think what really happens is when two men, sit down and talk. And when they become friends, they're able to share confidence in one another and in the relationship. And that's the key to our order, I believe. The fraternity between two men. Or if you like, mouth to ear. How we always transmitted the oral tradition. Now, and then we know that changed a while ago, don't we? But you and I can still subscribe to that mouth to ear. Here we are tonight doing exactly that. I know it's a bit of a loose metaphor, but it's nevertheless, it's there. When we sit down and we have confidence in the relationship, we can start to talk about the things that we don't agree with. We don't have to pander to one another, only say things that are agreeable. That's like a one-sided conversation. You have to wonder what the point is. Well, you and I have had the pleasure of time. Our labors come to an end. Not so very long ago, our labors didn't come to an end, and we had to work darn hard, darn long hours in order to survive. And now we have this advantage, and it's out of memory that this advantage has come to us. But what's important is we're able to contemplate. We're able to think, to discuss, to read, to share, to absorb new ideas. Now, if we're truly, I think one of the hardest things about our order is this notion of character building. Well, did I mention that the slogan, make a good man better? I think it's one of those messages inside of an envelope, inside of an encyclopedia. It's enormously clever. So what I'm going to try and do is take another one of Al's little adages. And I hope that he wasn't fooling around when he said this. He said, if you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. And I'm not saying that you're like a six-year-old. I'm just trying to do that to myself. I'm trying to make sense of things without making them unnecessarily complicated. You know? It's like any idiot can take something that's complicated and just wreck it. We don't need to do that. But the idea of sharing difficult topics allows us to reflect, to understand more about the thinking of the other person rather than our own thought. That helps us to define who we are, who I am, because my thoughts are different than yours. In some ways we may converge, we may overlap, hopefully. But clearly, you have a different history and a different background and different nuance. Different things interest you. And so you're going to emphasize different things, different ideas. And when I sit down and listen to you, and I listen to the next fellow, and I listen to the thousands of other Freemasons and people around the world, then I can begin to collect those opinions. And whatever's left is me. Afraid of the other person? Do I take it personally because their ideas, or should I take it personally? I'll ask you, should I? Because your idea doesn't agree with me, should I take it personally and become upset? I guess only if I'm foolish. Why shouldn't I be able to encourage you, encourage the discussion? And in doing that, demonstrate not necessarily that I'm agreeing with everything that you say, but that I can listen. I think there's a clear distinction. You could say, well, anybody that would overhear this conversation going on would say, obviously you're agreeing. Perhaps somebody maybe looking askance at the world would say that. It is what it is. It's a conversation. The more you can draw me out, the more I can draw you out. Maybe those weak ideas that I hold will start to make some sense in the recesses of my mind. Do you ever notice? You ever notice some things about history? Do you ever notice it's a curious phenomena? And at the very same time, it can be very clear and opaque. You know, it's a crystal clear. It can reveal very useful information. But it also reveals the misadventure of youthful exuberance and the role of probability or luck. Gee, wasn't I lucky when I was 17? Compared to the mind of a man my age, everything was lucky at the age of 17. Morality even comes pouring out of our history from plots and schemes, whether it's our own history or those of other people around us. Or the history out of mind from hundreds of years ago, where we see the diabolical nature of other civilizations. And it's interesting, and we can bore ourselves to tears thinking about it as some obscure history until that moment when you start to apply those lessons. And the way we do that is when you begin to think, there's no difference between that man lying on a hilltop in Greece and me. There's no different from the Egyptian laborer and me. There's no difference from my life and me being a Roman soldier, wondering about my feeding my family, being taken away from my crops as a farmer to be put into uniform and do battle because I was obligated. How different is that from the obligations you and I feel today? Different language, different time, different threat. similar challenges, always the need to try and improve, try and survive, try and do the best we can. How different is that? We protect ourselves from despots each time we remember the price paid in the tragedy. We've seen some really awful things happening through history. And as history unrolls around us or behind us, we can always say, it's odd how we seem to be repeating it. But it's history out of mind. Not everybody necessarily conveys the lessons from an earlier period. We look at some of the old cultures and sort of give them a short shrift. Why are they doing that? Why is it so important that children be taught the ancient languages and the ancient histories? Why? Oh, you can't apply it to a job, can you? If I've heard that once, I've heard that 1,000 times. Because it's important that we remember the tragedy. And we remember that to be watchful, to be mindful. We teach our children to remember the lessons of past generations to help them avoid paying a toll for the lessons that you and I have already learned, or our grandparents, or our great-great-great-grandparents, people that are no longer with us. History has been very kind to our fraternal order. There is enough speculation, just enough to tantalize the imagination. And in that respect, it is in very good company. We take the so-called, the quote, facts known to us at the time and make the best explanation possible at the time. That's how we carve out theories. Remember at the start? Geocentric, heliocentric? Well, we didn't have the sophisticated tools we have to measure everything, measure things that we do today. 100 years from now, we'll have new forms of measurement that will be startling compared to what we have today. Different, better. But at the time, we had to try and explain what those facts and observations, those observations were telling us. So make up a logic, tell the story. Now, tomorrow morning you're going to get up and you're going to see the sun rise, huh? Sunrise. We've all seen it. But we also know that the sun doesn't rise. The earth spins. So we know, we have an awareness and a knowledge at the same time. As the facts, as new information, new observations and measurement became known, then the story didn't work anymore. So we changed the story, the explanation, so that it would fit the facts. Ah, am I saying that everything is relative? Yep. I used to think of that, I thought that was quite clever when I was a lot younger, but let me just inject here, brethren, a little science moment. I know you're all craving, salivating. If you need another tumbler of Kool-Aid to get through this one, I wouldn't blame you. But this is when somebody starts to give you that nonsense about everything's relative, blah, 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 blah. That's somebody that can't keep their thoughts together, so they're going to say something outlandish. What can I say? What can we say? This term means different things to different people. Haha, a little pun, eh? Remember Dimitri and Tasso, the two Greeks? Dimitri says, the trouble with you, my friend, is you live too much in your head. And Tasso says, compared to whom? Dimitri says, well, compared to Achilles, the athlete. Tasso says, how about compared to Socrates? Dimitri says, okay, you win again. Compared to Socrates, you're a bozo. Is truth relative or absolute? I don't know on a Friday night if I want to think about relative or absolute. The Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu awoke from a dream in which he was a butterfly, or he wondered, was he really a butterfly? Or he wondered, was he really a butterfly who was now dreaming he was Shuang Zhu? In the modern Western world, philosophers have been obsessed by the relativity of knowledge to the knower. As we've seen, George Berkeley went so far as to say that physical objects only exist relative to the mind. Maybe that's where that idea came from, that nothing really exists until we begin to measure it. Physics has really taken us for quite a sprint down that very interesting intellectual path. Lots of jokes illustrate the relativity of the perception of time. Tonight, the perception is what it is, but you can feel tired. Is that how you measure? A snail was mugged by two turtles. When the police asked him what happened, he said, "I don't know. It all happened so fast." Sometimes I kill. You know, this is all natural humor. And then that snail, here's the snail, there's a knock at the door. And when the woman answers, there's only a snail, and she picks it up and throws it across the yard. 2 weeks later, there's another knock on the door. The woman answers the door, and there's the snail again. The snail says, "What was that all about?" Man, this is how we learn philosophy, isn't it, gentlemen, brethren? A man is praying to God. "Lord," he prays, "I'd like to ask you a question." The Lord responds, "No problem. Go ahead." "Lord," he says, "is it true that a million years to you is but a second?" "Yes, that is true." "Well then, what is $1 million to you?" $1 million to me is but a penny." "Ah, then Lord," you can see this coming, says the man, "may I have a penny?" "Sure," says the Lord. "Just a second." Oh, 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 oh. Second, million years, penny. I love it. So this is the notion of relativity. Frenchman walks into a bar. There's a parrot wearing a tuxedo perched on his shoulder. The bartender says, "Wow, that's cute. Where'd you get it?" Parrot says, "In France. They've got millions of guys like this over there." Mm-hmm. Oh, man. From the standpoint of pure reason, relative to him, everything else is going the wrong way. Now, all this is telling you and I is that perspective varies. Don't we have a lesson somewhere that we're challenged to try and look at the world through the eyes of another man? Phenomenally difficult. Why would we... Oh, sorry, I don't want to shatter my fragile ego here again. So I have to ask myself, why would I ever do that? Why would I ever care to see the world through somebody else's eyes? First, of course, I would wonder what I look like and how I sound, whether I make sense. A little too much truth, I think. Or not enough. I think the more interesting question is, once you get there, what would you do with that knowledge? So let's presume all the hundreds of you that are out there. I'll let you know when we reach thousands. I will. But let's presume right now that the hundreds of you out there are going to try and look at the world through the eyes of another person. What I want you to do is to start to, when you get there, poke your head up and take a look around. And then what I want you to do is tell me what you learn from that perspective. Not, gee, there, I've mastered it. No hubris. But what did you discover about yourself, the world around you? And where do you go? After you've done that, where do you go? End of journey? I don't think so. I really don't think so. Now, I know that this is going to scatter you across the hemispheres, the hundreds of you that are tuning in and listening. I don't think that we're so prone to, what's the term, where all the birds, you know, if you look at a flock of birds and they all seem to move in geometric shapes. Murmuration, I think it's called. Murmuration. Go and Google that one. That's interesting. I don't think that applies to our order. I think that we consciously make decisions. And there's some benefit in us complying or agreeing with one another. For some, it's very easy to fall into harness. And for others, it's a challenge, each to his own. Mm-hmm. But each can serve and perform in his own way. That seems to be the nature of our fraternal order. Very, very hard lesson. Go back and think about our history. Dionysus, not the Roman god, but the man, is said to have claimed history is philosophy teaching by example. History is philosophy teaching by example. So what have you learned so far? Seems to show us that we can claim to be the oldest fraternal order in the world. We've heard that. And I know I can hear you out there saying, you know, sucking your teeth and saying, oh, here we go again with that old canard. Let me try and look at that a little differently with you here, okay? A people always ends by resembling its shadow. All the people like us are we, and everyone else is they. That was Rudyard Kipling. Interesting fellow. Jungle Book. I want to talk to you a little bit about some discoveries. I don't know whether we want to get into time and the measurement. Why was the measurement of time so important to a particular group in the world? Well, it was China. I had walked around with this, you know, I love my own delusions. Dress me up in a tuxedo and everything oozes out of me. Anyway, you didn't tune in to hear me do this. The aphorism, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. This comes from a material by James Allen. A-L-L-E-N. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Not only embraces the whole of a man's being, but is so comprehensive as to reach out to every condition and circumstance of his life. A man is literally what he thinks, his character being the complete sum of all his thoughts. I'm not so sure I like the sound of that so far. There's implications. As the plant springs from and could not be without the seed, so every act of a man springs from the hidden seeds of thought and could not have appeared without them. This applies equally to those acts called spontaneous and unpremeditated, as to those which are deliberately executed. Act is the blossom of thought, and joy and suffering are its fruits. Thus does a man garner in the sweet and bitter fruitage of his own husbandry. Thought in the mind hath made us. What we are by thought was wrought and built. If a man's mind hath evil thoughts, pain comes on him as comes the wheel, the ox behind. If one endure impurity of thought, joy follows him as his own shadow. Sure. Man is a growth by law and not a creation by artifice, and cause and effect is as absolute and undeviating in the hidden realm of thought as in the world of visible and material things. A noble and godlike character is not a thing of favor or chance, but is the natural result of continuous effort and right thinking, the effort of long-cherished association with godlike thought. We are what we think. An ignoble and bestial character, by the same process, is the result of the continued harboring of groveling thoughts. So if I walk around acting the fool, acting obsequious because that strokes your ego, what does that say? Then that's what I become, huh? What if I have my own thoughts that I'm not going to share? This person is a bit of a prig, easily duped. What if I'm that dishonest? And there I'm defining myself. Man is made or unmade by himself. In the armory of thought, he forges the weapons by which he destroys himself. He also fashions the tools with which he builds for himself heavenly mansions of joy and strength and peace. By the right choice and true application of thought, man ascends to the divine perfection. By the abuse and wrong application of thought, he descends below the level of the beast. Because these two extremes are all the grades of character, and the man is their maker and master. Man, we don't have to look too far to see the depths. I feel kind of bad when good men are focused on the despair, as if that defines all that is the world around us. As if every moment is meaningless unless we're facing those critical life and death decisions. Well, I'd like to agree with that, but I'd be lying. There's so much more. Is that important? At the moment, it is. At that moment, in that location, it is. But when I'm throwing a stick into the water for my dog, that's important at that moment. When I'm looking at a painting in the art gallery or I'm listening to music, that's important. Trying to relax, instead of getting into a simple-minded road rage where I take every little vehicular innuendo as a personal slight, I just go with the flow. Get into a very zen headspace. You want to live well? Or not? It's your thoughts. Of all the beautiful truths pertaining to the soul which have been restored and brought to light in this age, none is more gladdening or fruitful of divine promise and confidence than this, that man is the master of thought, the molder of character, and the maker and shaper of condition, environment, and destiny. Now this is making me upset, rather. I want to believe that if I just sit in the atmosphere with all you good fellows, and I dress the dress, and I talk the talk, and I do the ritual, that that's going to transform me. And here this upstart is saying, man is a master of thought. Well, help me. What's the connection here? What's the connection? Does my environment, the people I associate with, the kind of conversation I have with you outside the door of the lodge? Well, now it defines me, doesn't it? My thoughts define who I am, and what I am. As a being of power, intelligence, and love, and the lord of his own thoughts. Man holds the key to every situation and contains within himself that transforming and regenerative agency by which he may make himself what he wills. Am I transposing logic and experience and opportunity with wishful thinking? Is that what's being said here? I'm missing something here. Man is always the master, even in his weakest and most abandoned state. But in his weakness and degradation, he is the foolish master who misgoverns his household. When he begins to reflect upon his condition and to search diligently for the law upon which his being is established, he then becomes the wise master, directing his energies with intelligence and fashioning his thoughts to fruitful issues. Don't give up the things that you enjoy. If you want to go out with your friends and just have the mood go, absolutely. That pure, uncomplicated joy and pleasure, go and do it. You need to. You are what you are. But if you're also a man of some reflection, if you begin to reflect upon your condition, I don't want you to feel that you're alone or floundering. You're not alone in that. I like to think of this as a way that men reinvent themselves. It comes from awareness. Such is the conscious master, and man can only thus become by discovering within himself the laws of thoughts, which discovery is totally a matter of application, self-analysis, and experience. It's like we have to grow up. I think I've had sort of an epiphany when I turned 50. Funny that I can look back at that and say that's when I was growing up. And now, over a decade later, I think there's so much more to learn. What did I learn from all of the what lessons did I learn? Well, I learned a different thing at the time than I do now, reflecting on them. But to dwell in my own history, that would be foolish. Absolutely foolish. Because of progress, change, new ideas, different decisions, just like you. Only by searching and mining are gold and diamonds obtained, and man can find every truth connected with his being if he will dig deep into the mine of his soul, and that he is the maker of his character, the molder of his life, and the builder of his destiny. He may unerringly prove, if he will watch, control, and alter his thoughts, tracing their effects upon himself, upon others, and upon his life and circumstances, linking cause and effect by patient practice and investigation, and utilizing his every experience, even to most trivial everyday occurrence, as a means of obtaining that knowledge of himself which is understanding, wisdom, and power. Overcome your desires. If I see any of you acting, walking around acting, exhibiting a life of piety, I want to, you know, deep inside my God-given soul, I want to hit you with a stick. I want to say to you, wise up, go relax, get with your friends, have a good time. What kind of music do you like listening to? What are you reading? What do you do that makes you feel good? What are you doing to help other people that makes you feel good? Ugh. That holy grail, huh? I want to be happy. Well, you're never going to be happy thinking that kind of tripe. You can have the tools. Do you have the tools to discover happiness? I think that's part of what Freemasonry does. Puts tools in front of us. Yes, if you're concrete, you can look at working tools, but they ooze with metaphor, don't they? Who puts tools in front of us that we can use? Equipment, information. So you sit down and start to sort it all out. And where do you start? Where you start is with what's important to you. Where I start is with what's important to me. He that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. For only by patience, practice, and ceaseless inopportunity can a man enter the door of the temple of knowledge. I love that. No, this isn't Masonic material that I'm going through here. This temple of knowledge is not, you know, it's not a subscription. It's a brilliant idea. Our fraternity recognized brilliant ideas. I began to see the complementarity, the advantage for all people. Remember, this isn't about limiting us. This is about the common good. How do you develop the common good? And then, you know, the idea that when we're performing acts, when I see you performing an act of goodness or kindness from just from your heart and helping somebody else, and I notice it out of the corner of my eye because you're not grandstanding, that little moment is enormously inspiring because it's truthful. There's candor in it. That's character. A man's mind may be likened to a garden which may be intelligently cultivated or allowed to run wild, but whether cultivated or neglected, it must and will bring forth. If no useful seeds are put into it, then an abundance of useless weed seeds will then fall and will continue to produce their kind. Just as the gardener cultivates his plot, keeping it free from weeds and growing the flowers and fruits which he requires, so may a man tend the garden of his mind, weeding out all the wrong, useless, and impure thoughts, and cultivating toward perfection the flowers and fruits of right, useful, and pure thoughts. By pursuing this process, a man sooner or later discovers that he is the master gardener of his soul and the director of his life. Jimmy, man, what you seem to be telling me is I've only got myself to blame. So much easier when I can point fingers and blame all my shortcomings on everybody else. I always love the term neuroses. I can be neurotic as old get all, as a cabbage patch doll, but we threw that term out. So am I master of my own future? Am I moving ahead? Well, this apparently takes work. By pursuing this process, a man sooner or later discovers that he is the master gardener of his soul. He also reveals within himself the laws of thought and understands with ever-increasing accuracy how the thought forces and mind elements operate in the shaping of his character, circumstances, and destiny. Thought and character are one. I'm going to have to. Isn't this getting a little Lutheran? Martin Luther, you know, you have an evil thought, therefore you're committing a. Again, there I go, being impulsive, eh? This does not mean that a man's circumstance at any given time is an indication of his entire character, but that those circumstances are so intimately connected with some vital thought element within himself that for the time being, they are indispensable to his development. So when we go through this, I'm going out and I'm all of a sudden I've had a terrible night. I've been too strident or insensitive in some way. Instead of condemnation, our friend Jim is, Mr. Allen is saying to us is we should explore this. Sit down and think seriously. And in order to do that, we have to overcome that sense of trepidation. Gee, I've done something untoward, something that wasn't completely whole and purposeful from every aspect. Never put off until tomorrow what you can do the day after tomorrow. So maybe I should park this one, not until tomorrow, but the day after. Mark Twain said that one. Thought and character are one. Every man is where he is by law of his being. Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this, didn't he? Really interesting man, this Malcolm Gladwell. It talks about this notion that, you know, if we try real hard, we can be, anyone can be what they want. Well, gee, science, the science that we have to stay in age doesn't really, being born to privilege does have advantages. It also brings to mind some of the Confucian philosophy. Are you content with what you have? That I strive to improve all the time, but at any moment, can you find that element of contentment or balance in your current circumstance? That very pleasant man who is enormously satisfied sitting in his garden, in his backyard. His labors are done. His needs are complete in that moment. That is a very, very wise man. A day without sunshine is like, you know, night. Every man is where he is by law of his being. The thoughts which he has built into his character have brought him there, and in the arrangement of his life there is no element of chance, but all is the result of a law which cannot err. So tell me, does that mean when somebody is full of himself, you know, seems to have that sun shining out of his every orifice, I'm supposed to like that? I'm supposed to buy that? Because I think in some ways that seems thoughtless to be, to the struggle of everybody around. Maybe that's the degree of diplomacy or subtlety that's needed. Why then? I sit and I look at the Dalai Lama, a man of enormous contentment and insight, and he's happy, and I don't feel awkward about that happiness. I don't feel that it's false at all. The difference, I guess, is that I'm always searching out that feeling of that idea of authenticity, because in the world that I live in, I've been sold these false promises by snake oil salesmen so often. When something useful does come along, it's really hard to grasp it. It really is. Me the fool? Oh, gee, everybody jumped on the bandwagon first. Ah, man. Anyone who thinks sitting in church can make you a Christian must also think that sitting in a garage can make you a car. So if I exude that, does it make me that? Garrison Keillor said that. I'm not so sure. You know. As a progressive and evolving being, man is where he is, that he may learn, that he may grow. So we're really, really punching up the idea of optimism here, brethren. Your choice in everything. Cup half full, cup half empty. Do you want to shy away from the world and hide behind bad manners and bad temper? There's no power in that. There's nothing in it. There's not even respect. Because nobody respects that, you know. Did I let out another sonic secret there? No, this is the way humanity is wired. That circumstances grow out of thought, every man knows, who has for any length of time practiced self-control and self-purification. For he will have noticed that the alteration in his circumstances has been in the exact ratio with his altered mental condition. I always hate these truisms. It's like a group hug. Everybody's feeling it. It's like, you know, when you've done something really well and everybody is praising you. I'm sorry. I'm going to have a non-science moment with you. I still have a hard time with that. Yeah, it's probably not so buried so deep in my psyche. Other people absorb that kind of thing like they're a sponge. Me? Maybe I'm a bit more stoic. Maybe that's genetic. It's like, well, so what? You know, yeah, okay. But, yeah, I guess at some level, yeah, it feels good to be. I think you've done something useful and worthwhile. But for the person, that to me would be cheapening. But keep sending in your cards and letters. The soul attracts that which it secretly harbors, that which it loves, and also that which it fears. It reaches the height of its cherished aspirations. It falls to the level of unchastened desires, and circumstances are the means by which the soul receives its own. The outer world of circumstance shapes itself to the inner world of thought. As above, so below? That's a very old truism. A man does not come to the pothouse or the jail by the tyranny of fate or circumstance, but by the pathway of groveling thoughts and base desires. Groveling thoughts and base desires end up in ruin. This begins to make me think about the grasshopper and the ant, you know? Little ant, very industrious, grasshopper is sort of cruising along, and then the moral of the story is, if you're industrious, you preserve yourself, you protect yourself. But Al said, the difference between genius and stupidity is that genius has its limits. Maybe he was living in the same world that you and I are living in, eh? Of course, I came from a different kind of gene pool than all of you. Go to heaven for the climate, and go to hell for the company, says Mark Twain. What did old Mark know about me, Samuel Clemens? What did you know? Upstart. Bit uppity, that man, I honestly. So one of these days I'm going to have to sit down and start talking about things much more Masonic than the time of day or the thoughts that change character or the issues of morality or the philosophies that are given in examples by history. Need to start to whitewash all of this. Make it simple. But then, I'm sorry, I just don't know how to do that anymore. Groucho Marx said it, you know. He said, I find television very educating. Every time somebody turns on the set, I go into another room and read a book. That about sums it up. We have an opportunity again. Begin to think of the opportunity that you're faced with. And let's say that Jimmy Allen has a point here, that we can control our thoughts, and the kind of thoughts that we have begin to shape and determine our character. I like to be practical about this and think that, you know, for a few nanoseconds, I began to think that maybe and perhaps we leave the bigger organizational processes to our Grand Lodge and put all of our energy into the functioning of our lodges. And we get into the Cornerstone Project in a big way. Big way. We embrace it. It's something that, this is like something that we've wanted to find, a method that we've wanted for and needed for a long time. Only we start to make executive decisions about it instead of whining and complaining and la 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 la. So we begin to put our house in order. Every new person initiated. That we begin to look at the function of our lodge with balanced eye. Do we balance off? Are we doing enough to educate? Well, we could absolutely say no. I read somewhere that in a day gone by, a fellow couldn't come into a lodge until the newest member in the lodge had been taught everything that there was about being a Mason, because it was his duty at the door to instruct the new initiate. You think about it. Not the old sages in the room. Not the old sages, but the newest member of that lodge had to be taught. And so there was no rush. That it took time to season the person's mind, to teach the instruments. Now you think about that as a challenge. How much would that take? Oh, get over, everything would come to a halt. It would not. But things would be different than they are today, wouldn't they? Because we would have to sit down and think about what our priorities would be. What would we teach? What would we want the new man in the lodge to teach? Oh, let me shoulder my way to the head of the crowd. I'm the wizard in the room, so I know better than everybody else. Sorry, that kind of thinking doesn't work. We are a lodge. We're a meritocracy. We advance by merit. And we do things democratically for the common good. So if we were to roll up our sleeves and say, well, this is something that's important to us, and we can become the geocentric, we can have a geocentric notion of the lodge. Lodge is the center, everything is orbit around it. I wonder whether that would take you and I across hundreds of years of Masonic history, 300-500 years Masonic history, where the Grand Lodge did not exist. The Grand Lodges did not exist. Goose and Gridiron were only a thought in a retailer's mind. But the idea of lodge, of some common protection, some standard, order, recognition, that these values were important to men. They happened up in the, you know, Scandinavia and in Britain. Celtic areas really embraced it, didn't they? Yeah. But these ideas, the bare bones ideas of fraternity and fraternal organizations were not new. In some, they were cloaked in religious orders that still exist to this day. I suppose a fool would say all of that is enormously bad. Well, if you close one eye when you're looking at the world. I guess you can claim that. But do you ever speculate and wonder what would happen if we put our shoulder to the wheel and tried to look at the principles and begin to do it so that everybody was included? That we looked at the very old fellows, those fellows that were busy visiting. They don't have the energy to do it anymore. But they got us where we are. And we need to thank them for that. But we also need to be able to explain the connection between what they were able to do and the changing expectations. Yeah, things have changed a bit. Similar, but different today, the 21st century. So that we're all part of it. We're all included when that door closes. How would we go about doing it? Well, it would take time. And we would have to stop with this hasty pudding. The hasty pudding is more and more. All high level of degree work. Lots of meetings. Wow, lots of meetings. Are we having enough? I think more than enough. We probably need to, people smarter than me need to sit back and rethink that. What's enough? 10? 8? I guess what's enough for me is if you hung a gallery show of Monet and I could come in every single day, would I tire of Monet? Maybe that's not a good example. No, I don't want Christmas every day. I want lodge meetings and I want the things that I do with you to be special. Special, not routine, not boring, not going through the motions. I want to be in a lodge where everybody gets my need and understands, not to waste our collective time, but to get on with something that's interesting and contributes to the purpose of the night. Is that asking too much? Well, I'm afraid I've been in lodges that can do that. Maybe lodges that aren't doing it haven't been had the opportunity to be aware that it's possible. We are equipped with a phenomenal constitution that allows us to do this. But the balance, what would the work be in the lodge then if we're not initiating people continuously? And if we see our old boys going home eventually, and our numbers changing in a lodge, what's the panic? What's the panic? We'll always rise to the occasion. Whether we're old or new, seasoned or green, we're resourceful. We are resourceful. The thing that we're hearing from our friend Alan here tonight is that, you know, it's the thoughts behind it. If you had, a lodge of 15 men show up, purposeful, be together to share ideas and discussion. Not to be silly and carried away with emotion. Not to be wasteful and trivialize what we're doing. But to have a thoughtful and sometimes a heady conversation where perhaps we can just come away with a different understanding. That the goal of sitting down together was always to reach a deeper and better understanding every single time. I think that may be off-putting, and I don't know if that would necessarily be something that would be enjoyable all the time. But what, a third of the time, a half of the time? Is it reasonable for me to ask you to set aside a portion of the meeting so that the fellows in the room that want to contemplate, that want to put the cares and pressures of the world outside, to be able to focus on something honorable and good. be able to have that moment without the constant backslapping and glad handing that goes on. You know, do I have to go somewhere else to find that peace of mind? I don't think I should have to. But it means that you have to get it. You have to do it, but be okay about it. I wouldn't want you to do it and feel resentful. That would be wrong, and then that would be un-Masonic of both of us. There's not a school marm that's going to hold us to that standard. That's up to you and I. We have to hold ourselves to that standard. And that, I think, is very, very hard. Very hard. We have this opportunity. But it's hard to, I think it's a challenge to go from the way that we've been for decades. And I think this is where common purpose becomes part of our lives in the 21st century. The way to do that is by discussing, by talking. If we're going to learn, then it's important that we begin to listen at least half the time. You want to know what it would be like in an ideal world if you were going to be a student? You learn to listen most of the time. You absorb ideas like a sponge, at least half the time. It's important to be able to talk them over. That's how we begin to let those ideas resonate. You begin to have meaning. Like I would say to you about this, my friend, what part of this makes sense to you? What part of it doesn't? Is there anything in this? Well, for hundreds of years, we have been resilient. We're like the ultimate shapeshifters. We adapt. We're very good at it. But we're not foolish. Yeah, we try things that seem to be a bit trendy. But at the core, we always have our feet on the ground. Always, always, always. Are we wrong to try new ideas? Absolutely not. Out of some of those new ideas and that effort builds confidence, a sense of confidence that we can try, that we could take a risk, but we'll do it together. Not so risky. We're not jumping out of planes without parachutes. We're trying ideas out. The more we adhere to our history, the more we learn to our history, there's some balance in it. George Carlin, the reason I talk to myself is because I'm the only one whose answers I accept. There you go. I don't want to prolong this. There's a fellow that sort of really probed thinking, even notions of mental illness, Thomas Szasz. Some of you may have heard about him. He said, two wrongs don't make a right, but they sure make a good excuse. So we do what we do as much as we can, as often as we can. You and I talk about stone a lot, don't we? Not thick as a brick, but the monuments that have continued to exist because they were made out of stone. Well, you and I know that eventually the stone breaks down, but it takes a long, long, long time to break down. Out of mind, out of the living history of one person. We like durability. We think it gives us a sense of permanence and security. And it does, I think. Henry James said, "Stonehenge stands as lonely in history as it does on the Great Plain." Of the many puzzling megaliths, the enormous works of primeval architecture scattered around northwestern Europe, the most impressive and perhaps most famous is Stonehenge. Oh, we can walk on the heretical side a little bit here. I'm not going to tile anything here. On an undulating plain near the cathedral city of Salisbury in southern England are the remains of two concentric circles of large stones enclosing rows of smaller ones. In the early Middle Ages, this pile was christened Stonehenge, from the Old English for hanging stones. When archaeologists found similar remains elsewhere around the Atlantic fringe of Europe, they tried to give Stonehenge its proper place in history. Most other megaliths were single stones or groups of stones called menhirs. That's from Breton or Welsh, meaning long stone. They were set upright, but Stonehenge was a large open-air structure of stones symmetrically arranged. Some have been shaped to lie on the uprights, those plinths. The tops of some showed a projecting piece, a tenon, to fit into the mortise hole of the stone that rested on it. The individual menhirs were single feats of primitive engineering. Stonehenge was something more, a work of primeval architecture. Archaeologists who made timetables from remains in Mesopotamia, Egypt, and the Aegean dated Stonehenge near the dawn of European history. They would not believe that Stonehenge could be the work of barbarians who had neither metal nor writing. Stonehenge, they said, must have been a distant offshoot from the centers of Western civilization in the Mediterranean. Megalithic missionaries, they said, must have brought the advanced Mediterranean technology across Europe. These migrants supposedly were not fresh contingents of Neolithic farmers, but a spiritual aristocracy. And that had the moment to pause and reflect and contemplate. They referred to back then, I guess if you're the only game in town, you become a spiritual aristocracy. Today, you can achieve that, but you're in the crowd, huh? The peculiarities of their sepulchral architecture suggested at least three groups of such missionaries in Great Britain. This appealing vision confirmed the fertility of the revered sources of Western culture in the Eastern Mediterranean, and at the same time affirmed the incompetence of mere barbarians. Without the inspired know-how of Egypt and Mycenae, behind them, who could have created such grand structures in those remote centuries? Now, I'm struck again, you know. Maybe it's my ADHD kicking in. I don't have that. But the Egyptians, you know, the pyramids are still there. We look at the Greek temples, and they're all in ruins. But the ideas of the Greeks are around us every single day. The philosophy that we're going over earlier, it's a product that was produced from the Greeks. You and I, we like to think of ourselves as students of Pythagoras, don't we? Well, we knew he went away to Egypt, and he studied it and came back. Tisk, tisk. I don't think that he invented the engineering. But, you know, if he's a new guy, comes back after he's been away for a long time and he's full of ideas, hey, he might as well take credit for it. I didn't see thousands of Egyptians all standing up saying, no, no, no. That wasn't your idea. So you might as well. You've got to credit somebody. So you might as well say, well, it's him. But make no mistake, his contribution to mathematics and philosophy was brilliant. But I guess he must have annoyed a lot of people in Greece. He just wrecked his temples and schools, his gymnasia. hardly a trace left. Eh? Barbarians, well, you know where that came from. It seemed to gain a lot of traction and popularity when Christianity was trying to make its, you know, shoulder its way into the lexicon. It was, you know, there's times when it may be hard for us to think that it wasn't as prevalent as it was today, or it is today. And, you know, you had to wonder whether it had viability. Well, what would it have its rightful place and have enough support that it makes sense? And can we communicate these ideas? But the idea of barbarianism and paganism, you know, it was all about, you know, trying to build a case. We still do that today. We just call it spin doctoring. But the self-serving vision proved an illusion, a parable of the dangers of seeming too wise about man's powers of creation. An unpredicted new 20th century technique for dating man's past creations dissolved the tempting vision of prehistoric missionaries crossing Europe to instruct Neolithic barbarians in the architecture of megaliths. It was a surprising byproduct of World War II research for the atomic bomb. Now, that was certainly a blight on the conscience of mankind. In 1945, an ingenious atomic physicist, Willard Frank Libby, and he was born in 1908, by the way, and his students at the University of Chicago suggested that measuring the presence of a rare isotope of carbon 14 might help date archaeological remains. This form of carbon is always found in the atmosphere in microscopic quantities, and it disintegrates at a fixed rate. When organic objects cease to grow, they cannot assimilate carbon. Thus, by comparing the amount of carbon 14 in the atmosphere today, it might be possible to fix the approximate date when a fossilized organism died or when a tree was cut. My goodness, it's all relative. Test what's in that. Test what's going on in the air. Carbon-14 decays. I do the rate of decay by the amount of time. It gives me a factor. How old is this? I had no idea it was that simple. This provided a better method than... Boy, the next time I see you fellas over a glass of Kool-Aid, we're going to have an interesting conversation. This provided a better method than any before for dating objects up to 50,000 years in age. When checked by another technique, dendrochronosity, the use of very old trees to measure antiquity, it appeared that Libby's assumptions about the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere in the distant past were not quite correct. Whoops. Tests in the rings of trees several thousand years old revealed that the radiocarbon level before 1000 BC had deviated from the present level and was higher than now. Kalur. This changed the yardstick for measuring antiquity and meant that specimens were even older than suggested by Libby's examples based on constant carbon-14 production in the atmosphere. If I don't find out how old Stonehenge is by the end of this show, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to put myself in the corner here. When applied to Stonehenge and the associated organic remains, these new techniques carried a startling message. They pushed the date for the construction of Stonehenge back to about 2000 BC, long before the Cyclopean stone walls of Mycenae. Stonehenge, one of the most impressive, now became one of the earliest works of European architecture. The work of, quote, mere barbarians, people who had neither metal nor writing. Gee, just like us. It meant that, so what we're really finding out here is that there was some genius, ingenuity that was at work. Not a bag full of money, and all kinds of luxurious equipment. Stonehenge, one of the most impressive, was built by people without metal or writing. So how in the world did they carve it, cut it out? It meant that other megalithic monuments could be dated from that early age, 2000 BC. 2000 BC. So we had Chinese culture going back that far, didn't we? Yeah. I wasn't around 2000 BC. Nope. Ice age over Canada. Ice sheet. The enduring monuments of primeval architecture then were no longer witnesses to the outreaching power of Mycenae. Instead, they reveal man's irrepressible creative powers everywhere and democratized the history of man, the creator. That's you. Yeah, pony up. That's you. This is part of your gene pool. Tap into it. Your thoughts. The way you form your thoughts can reinvent you. Here you are. How many examples do we need? So we say, oh, well, for me, this is like blind guys climbing Mount Everest and playing golf better than I ever could. And I've told these guys, you know, I work with a bunch of wonderful people over in a couple of little towns. Some people would know them as disabled. I call them terrors. They're always making me look bad. They golf, they hike, they sail, they climb mountains. Man. So it's not for any advantage that we should be thinking. Gee, it's always so hard. Well, shoulder to shoulder, I guess I don't really have much of a leg to stand on. That guy has something, though, that I don't have. He has desire. That, for me, is authenticity. That is what I like about you. The authentic, real person. You're going to be a Mason all your life. Be yourself. Don't be a phony. Don't try and pretend. Be yourself. I'll recognize you that way. I'll see you in the crowd. Perhaps I'll see you committing a random act of kindness. You know, the ones you do when nobody's looking. The act that means so much more. The politicians and the politics, we keep saying over and over again that it doesn't exist. Some of us are actually going to believe it, but it does. We need that. We have to have different opinions about things. It's the way we define the ideas, put some shape to them, get them out there. I don't know if I want to think that it's all political. You know, it's sort of there's something swarmy or dodgy about it. No, it's a person's opinion. If you were to say to me in that way, is there politics in order? I'd say absolutely not. What there is people speaking passionately of things that are important and sharing their ideas. My goodness, earlier in this show, I said that the only way I could learn more about myself is by encouraging you to explain and define your thoughts. And there I go with that little ego growing and growing. Your thoughts are so much different. Must be politics. That's an easy way to kick the pins out from under thoughts that don't agree with mine. Remember, it's all about me. All about the ego. Except it isn't. I find that bloody tedious. But then I'm just getting old and crotchety here. I want to see the authenticity. I want to see the ingenuity. That means try stuff. Try stuff. You never try anything. You never fail. You don't fail. You're not doing anything. You're not moving. Instead, they revealed man's irrepressible creative power everywhere and democratized the history of man, the creator. Monoliths. Megaliths. For now, it appeared that the great prehistoric works were not dispersed from a single source. From this, too, we learn not to underestimate man's powers to create. If we see that what we must not always expect to know, the why or the how. Archaeologists did not see how these prehistoric Britons could have moved 50-ton megaliths. Still, Stonehenge must have been the precocious work of remote antiquity. What was the point of it all? Well, it was a practice. These folks that took care with burial ritual. And And the primeval megalithic monuments remind us of that. And it reminds us of that early man tried to create something that would outlast the brief lifespan of his life. You and I have taken these kind of notions of permanence, something that lasts longer than out of memory, and projected them through ideas. Not even a structure, but a structure of the mind. The structures of the mind that cannot be killed. History shows us how many times the utter futility of people that have tried to kill an idea. We're still here. Ideas don't die. There. That's the permanence. That's stone. That's indefinite. That's beyond something that can erode. The basic ideas. In order to do this work, we have to know the truths. We have to know the facts, not opinion. That's why we talk. We bash around the ideas, you and I. We come up with all kinds of opinions, and then we find the facts at the heart of it all. When King James I visited Stonehenge in 1620, he ordered the famous architect and set designer Inigo Jones to draw a plan of the monument and explain how it had been built. Jones concluded that Stonehenge was no work of the Druids or of the ancient Britons. The learning of the Druids consisted more in contemplation than practice. I like to think that they had some influence on thought and the way people went about their business ever since. In the ancient Britons, accounting at their chiefest glory to be wholly ignorant in whatever arts. Stonehenge then must have been the work of the Romans, for they alone had the required technology. There you go, James I. 40 years later, John Aubrey, who lived near Stonehenge, reviewed the monument for King Charles II. He explored the site and so became known as England's first archaeologist. The ring of cavities he discovered came to be called Aubrey Holes. In them, supposedly, other stones had once been placed, dating the structure long before Roman or Saxon times. He said that the Druids, being the most eminent priests or order of priests among the Britons, 'tis odds, but that these ancient monuments were temples of the priests of the most eminent order, the Druids, and are as ancient as those times. This inquiry, I must confess, is a groping in the dark, although I have brought it from an utter darkness to a thin mist, and have gone than anyone before me. So I've started to explain a little bit about something permanent. Our ideas, your ideas, and the authenticity of all that you are. Tonight has been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to schedule another one of these shows very, very soon. We want to sit down with a very good and interesting fellow. His name is Rick Cadet. We're going to talk on air. I hope that you'll join us. And until we're together again, commit random acts of Masonic kindness wherever you be. Take care of each other. Thanks for joining. Bye.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. We